Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Listeners to this program may wonder where we get our guests. Many of them happen to be close colleagues of mine. I know their work and feel comfortable featuring them in a discussion. Other times I'll stumble across an interesting book or article, and not knowing the author, I take a chance and see where the conversation runs. I'm usually quite pleased with that result. Today's guest, though, was discovered in a rather unique place, some 40 feet underwater off the Florida Keys. You heard me right. On a recent scuba diving vacation down south, I had the chance to chat with some folks on our catamaran, and it just so happens that my dive buddy at the Benwood Wreck and the world-famous Scuba Jesus was none other than Professor Russell Cluckley, who is an associate professor of religion at Augsburg College in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Professor Cluckley was kind enough to lead me on an underwater tour of that World War II boat and was patient enough to put up with a rookie diver managing a relatively strong current that day. More importantly, though, Russell is a scholar with a deep interest in the role of theology and science around the time of the Protestant Reformation and shortly thereafter. And given that historical episodes happen to be our most popular, I just knew I had to have him on as a guest. Russell, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate the invitation.
I want to once again thank you for being such a generous and patient dive buddy down there in the Florida Keys. Not only were you tolerant enough to put up with my propensity to chew up air really fast, but we also had the chance to learn a little bit about this Scuba Jesus. For our listeners who don't know what that is, and we'll put a picture of it up at our Facebook fan page. Could you give a quick summary of what Scuba Jesus is?
Well, sure, and you were there too, so you can help me with this. The more proper name for what it is that we encountered there is the statue called Christ of the Abyss. It's what would you say about 8 feet tall, sunk in about 20 to 25 feet of water. Was actually a gift to the Marine Sanctuary there off of Key Largo by the manufacturer of scuba gear from Italy, Cresti, back in the 1960s, I believe. The statue was put there in 1965 and has been an attraction for divers and snorkelers ever since.
Yeah, and I looked that up later, and I learned about that. Our captain aboard the ship also mentioned a little bit about the tale of it. But you noticed something that was really interesting. You're an expert diver. You've been down there quite a bit, and one of the things that you said when we came up is that you said Scuba Jesus is looking a little bit crusty. So what's up with that?
Yeah, well, you have a very broad definition of expert here, but I have been diving on that site several times over the years. Most recently, prior to our trip, several years ago, and I noticed that the statue seemed to have much more coral growing on it than I had recalled from last time. So that was the reason for my comment.
And what did Captain Bob say about that? Because I thought that was a fascinating story.
Well, he had a story behind that neither you nor I have been able to document independently. But what he told us was that for a long time that the statue was regularly cleaned to keep the growth off of it. But since the statue is actually located in a government protected area, apparently in the recent past some atheists objected to having a religious statue there on what's technically government property. I'm not sure who made this decision, but apparently the way that it was handled then was simply to let the coral grow and accumulate on the statue to the point now where it actually qualifies as a coral reef, and so it's protected for environmental reasons, if not for religious ones.
Yeah, I just love that story because it's using one policy against another in order to support one's policy. So fun. If anybody else can validate that story, we'd be happy to entertain that. So please go ahead and contact us here at Research on Religion. Well, we're not here to talk about snorkeling or scuba diving. Instead, and I think our guests want this as well, we want to discuss what I consider to be a very fascinating topic, which is the role of scientific scholars and theology during the Reformation era, with a particular focus on Johannes Kepler, who was born about a half century after Luther made his famous mark on Christianity. Kepler, as I think we will find out, is a pretty interesting character who really encapsulated the intellectual and spiritual fervor of the late 16th and early 17th centuries. But for those of us who may have been sick that day that Kepler was taught in high school history class, could you give us a quick summary of who Johannes Kepler was?
Sure, I'll give you the textbook version, and then we can back up and fill in what I think are some of the more interesting details about his life. Kepler was born in 1571 in a small town called Weilderstadt, which is very close actually to Stuttgart. His childhood was not a very pleasant one. His father was a mercenary who disappeared at several points in his childhood, and presumably was killed in battle. His mother was a quite interesting figure in and of herself. She was later put on trial for witchcraft, in which Kepler, as an adult, was called to her defense. Interestingly, not because Kepler, as he's sort of remembered as a hero of modern science, his defense really did not have to do with the fact that witches do not exist, but rather simply the contention that his mother was not one. But nonetheless, she was a very important influence in his life. The story is told that in 1577, so when Johannes was still a rather small boy, took him outdoors to see the famous comet of 1577. And apparently that had quite a profound impact on him and awakened his interest. But as Kepler grew older, his ambitions turned more actually to the ministry. He was raised as a Lutheran. The territory in which he was living at the time was a staunchly Lutheran area. He was received into the school system that was set up by the Duke of Württemberg, which recognized particularly gifted students, essentially gave them a stipend or a scholarship, moved them through the educational system, and eventually into the University of Tübingen, which is where Kepler ended up. It was while Kepler was at Tübingen, again with the ultimate aim of becoming a Lutheran pastor, that he also encountered, as his astronomy and mathematics teacher, Michael Meslin. Now, Meslin was one of the few people at the time who was committed to Copernicus's idea about heliocentrism, that is, overturning the prevailing view of Ptolemy that the Earth is the center of the solar system, and adopting instead of the model that Copernicus proposed. Meslin was one of the few who seemed to have been convinced that what Copernicus provided was not only a workable mathematical model, but that his system actually represented the solar system as it is. So it is as a result of Meslin's influence that Kepler also became convinced of the Copernican model. For reasons I suspect we'll get into in our conversation, Kepler was directed away from the Lutheran ministry while at Tübingen, and in recognition of his mathematical skills was sent to be a teacher in the small Austrian town of Graz. There was a Lutheran school there in what was and still is a predominantly Catholic territory. And it was while he was teaching there that Kepler had this sort of flash of insight while teaching one day into what he thought was God's geometrical blueprint for the universe based on an arrangement of the Platonic solids, these geometrical figures that have equal areas on every side, and nesting the orbs of the planets within those figures. One of the things that I think is really interesting about Kepler is that even though he is remembered today chiefly as the discoverer of the three laws of planetary motion that are named after him, he actually stumbled across those laws in pursuit of a lifelong quest after this idea that he had discovered this this model that by which God had created the universe with some adaptation later on. Because of religious difficulty in Graz, again being a Catholic area in which Lutherans were tolerated for a while, the new Archduke at the end of the 16th century made the decision to impose religious conformity in the area, which meant for Lutherans like Kepler, now their choices were either to convert or to leave. Kepler was forced out for a while, invited back in for a short time, but his days there were numbered. In the meantime, he had caught the attention of Tycho Brahe, the famous observational astronomer who was working as the imperial mathematician for Emperor Rudolf in Prague. Brahe had recognized Kepler's genius and so invited Kepler to come to Prague to work as his assistant. As it turned out, Brahe died shortly after Kepler had moved to Prague, and Kepler inherited that very important position of imperial mathematician, continued to work in Prague. It was while he was there that he discovered the first two of his famous laws of planetary motion. And continued to work with the data that Brahe had accumulated. Their main project was to compose a new set of astronomical tables charting the paths and positions of the planets to update older tables that had become outdated. And so while he was working on that project, it's where Kepler was knocking his head against the orbit of Mars. He couldn't get the orbit of Mars to reconcile with what the prevailing theory of a perfectly circular motion for the planets, what that motion should have been. And there it occurred to Kepler that if the motions of the planets were put in the form of ellipses rather than in circles, the mathematics would work out much more cleanly. So from there, Kepler eventually moved to Linz when the religious situation in Prague became difficult. He worked in Linz for a while and then finally died in the year 1630.
You mentioned that he was an imperial mathematician, inheriting that from Tycho Brahe. What does that mean? I mean, that when I was reading your papers on this, imperial mathematician sounds so cool. I think I would want to do that.
Well, it was an important title. Rulers tended to have mathematicians at their courts for a number of reasons. We have to remember that charting the course of the stars and the planets was the way that people kept time back in all the way through the early modern period, which is when Kepler lived. So there was a great strategic, even military advantage into being able to calculate seasons and changes of seasons and so on with great accuracy, also for purposes of navigation, accuracy in being able to chart the courses of stars and planets was very important. But there was also an astrological function and interest in this as well. We have to remember this was a time in which people were committed to the idea that there is a very close relationship between what happens in the movements of stars and planets with things that happen on Earth. So to be able to predict especially unusual events like eclipses and comets and things like that with an eye towards gauging and measuring their astrological significance, was deemed to be very, very important as well. And also one of the things that people tend to forget today is that one of the main functions of astrology back in Kepler's time was actually medical. The idea being that human beings as individuals, we represent what was called a microcosm, a miniature version of the universe. There's a direct correlation between what's going on around us cosmologically with what affects us as individuals based on when we're born, under what sign, and so on. There are actually medical charts that were produced showing what constellations affect, in particular, what parts of the body. For rulers, and in this case, the emperor, to have a mathematician available who could read those astrologically, what those charts portended was seen to be very, very important.
Now, you mentioned that Kepler became interested in astronomy when he was a small child and saw the 1577 comet flying through the air. I can imagine that's going to have a big impact on him. But I'm always curious how the scholars that I have as guests on the show come about their interest in their topics. How did you become interested in Kepler? He wasn't flying through the air like a comet when you were a young child, was he?
No. Let me back up, first of all, and say something that I should have said earlier about Kepler's childhood and the difficulty that that he was experiencing at that time. He actually suffered from smallpox as a youth, which damaged his eyesight for the rest of his life. Now, you might think for an astronomer that would be a great disadvantage, and it is. The terms that we use for to describe the roles of people at the time are somewhat fluid. I tend to refer to Kepler more as a mathematician than an astronomer. If we think of astronomers as people who are engaged in the work of observation. One of the reasons that Kepler was interested in working with Brahe was because of Brahe's expertise as an observational astronomer, something that Kepler himself could not do. So he was very interested in having the data that Brahe was gathering in order to apply the mathematics to that data. And of course, Brahe had an equal interest in Kepler as having the mathematical skills to work with the data that he was collecting. So the connection between mathematics and astronomy is very important, with mathematics and being Kepler's strong suit there. My interest in Kepler goes back to the 1980s when I was working on my doctoral dissertation that involved Martin Luther's understanding of creation, his use of creation in the natural order in his explanation of real presence in the Lord's Supper. You know how doctoral dissertations go. They have to be get off on these really, really specific specific areas of interest. But this whole connection between theology and the natural order and the way that people bring together those two things was something that was of great interest to me. Of course, Luther maintained a firm conviction in the real presence of both the divinity and humanity of Christ in the elements of the Lord's Supper and the bread and the wine, but had taken exception to the prevailing Roman Catholic. The doctrine of transubstantiation is the means to describe that, so I was getting into all of these areas of natural philosophy and so on. So I thought it might be interesting to kind of turn the question around a little bit and to move from Luther, the theologian, how he was looking at the world of nature in connection with his theology, to take a look at someone more known, who I knew to be a Lutheran. I didn't know much else about Kepler than that, but someone else who was a Lutheran, to see how he might have used his understanding of the natural order to reconcile a Lutheran understanding of the sacrament. And boy, was I surprised at what I found out.
Yes, it's those little surprises. People don't look down a certain avenue or an alleyway, and you look down there and you find some of the most interesting things. And that is certainly what we see with Kepler, and your writings really illuminate that. Now, one of the things you just mentioned was this term natural philosopher. And that was a term that was used to describe, as you say, Luther, but also Kepler. And I think natural philosopher might be what today we would call a scientist. But at that time, scientists were both interested in theology and science. And that seems to be the going trend at the time there in the 16th and 17th century. What did the academic world really look like back in Luther's day up through Kepler?
Well, we use the term science and scientist to describe folks like Kepler and their work, because that's the term that's familiar to us. Actually, the term science and scientists were not used in Kepler's time in the way that we use them at all. Those terms come into use largely in the 19th century, and have become so commonplace to us that it's almost difficult, almost impossible for us to think outside of those terms when we look back historically at people whose main interests were in discovering, describing, and explaining the natural order of things. The word science, of course, comes from the Latin scientia, and what is one of the things that's very interesting to me is when you look at the writings of the time, both in theology as well as in the realm of natural philosophy, scientia applies to all sorts of things, including quite often scientia Dei, knowledge of God. One of Luther's associates, Philip Melanchthon, who was largely responsible for the development of education in the Lutheran model, profoundly influenced the curriculum and approaches to teaching at the University of Tübingen, including in the areas of natural philosophy as Kepler encountered it. Himself wrote a commentary on Aristotle's Physics, where he freely uses the term scientia Dei, knowledge about God. And interestingly, when he talks about physics and describes the teachings of physics, there he uses the term doctrina, which is, of course, where we get the word doctrine from, more often associated in the realm of theology, but to describe teachings about the natural order. So it's a very, very different environment there that gets even reflected in the language. And with my students, I try as much as possible to avoid using terms like science and scientists to describe the period for two reasons. One is it's not authentic to the period itself. And secondly, I think the difficulty, even the awkwardness sometimes that we have in avoiding those terms in talking about this period and these people and these issues is a reminder of us of just how different the world at that time was.
It is interesting because you point out a number of the books that he wrote, and some of us might be familiar with the titles if we were paying attention in high school history class. He wrote a book called World Harmonies,
right.
And he also wrote another book called Cosmographic Mysteries. And what you point out is that if you read the opening parts of these books, it's not just posed as what we would call a science book, but with in the case of World Harmonies, he calls it, Kepler himself calls it a doxology in praise of the Creator's ordered cosmos, and his cosmographic mystery, he sees himself as being a priest of the book of nature.
Right, right. This term priest of the book of nature is one that Kepler had inherited from a tradition that goes way back to the ancient world, to the Greeks, about two books. The idea is that God's revelation comes to the world in two forms, in writing, in sacred texts, like the Bible, and that God's revelation to the world also comes in the natural order itself. That is, that nature and creation, the cosmology as a whole, is a book that's the product of God's writing, so to speak. And so the idea here, certainly the tradition that Kepler embraces, is that the revelation in these two books are compatible with each other. There is no conflict between the two. And so part of the task when things begin to develop in the course of our understanding of things, where a conflict begins to appear, is that there has to be a way of reconciling these two conflicts. When Kepler's path to the Lutheran ministry is closed to him, he embraces his calling then, as he describes in this term, to be a priest of the Book of Nature, which he understands to be just as holy a calling as a call to the ordained ministry. And so he pursues it with that spiritual motivation very much in mind. Already in the cosmographic mystery, he is describing the work of the astronomer, the mathematician, the natural philosopher, that the proper goal of that work is doxology, praise of the Creator for the creation. As I mentioned, his sort of eureka moment there at Graz comes when he believes that he has discovered God's blueprint for the creation of the universe, and this is what motivates him for the rest of his career. Now, when he comes to the recognition that the movement of planets is elliptical and not perfect circles, that pretty much distorts the perfect model that he had developed in Graz based on spheres. But he's still committed to this idea that there is this notion of geometrical and mathematical order in the cosmos, and what happens in the world harmony, which he publishes much later, 1618-1619. He has by this point transposed his geometrical model to a harmonic one, to a musical one. That is, that the geometrical model ratios get transposed into ratios of musical harmony. You have to forgive me here. I'm not a musician, so I'm not quite sure the best way to describe this. But when you actually take a look at the world harmony, which, by the way, is the text that contains his third law of planetary motion that accounts for why the planets are spaced as they are proportionally, what you will find in there are musical notations, musical scales that correspond to the movement of the planets. Now, Kepler did not believe that there's actually movement going on in the heavens. But what he was arguing is that the heavens were composed by God in such a way that musical harmonies provide the basis for that arrangement.
It's a neat way of thinking about it, because I know a lot of musicians, especially those who are deep in their faith, really do see music as a language of God that God has given us. And you know, to see this is woven through the fabric of the entire universe is not surprising for somebody of great spiritual faith, which brings me to the next question. You mentioned that Kepler was sidetracked or moved away from his initial career path, which was to become a Lutheran minister. Why did he give up on that career path?
Well, it's not that he gave up on it. It's that he was actively discouraged from moving in that direction by his theology professors at the University of Tübingen. One of the things that's happening at this point, particularly in Germany, is you mentioned that the Reformation is well underway. By this point, some of the divisions are beginning to show, not just between Protestants and Catholics, but among the Protestants themselves. Followers of Luther do not agree on some of the important issues of Luther's theology, about how to interpret it, how to apply it. And a lot of these have to do particularly with a Lutheran understanding of the Lord's Supper and how it is that Christ is present, whether Christ is present both bodily as well as spiritually in the elements. And of course, the followers of Calvin, their presence is very prevalent at this time too, who take this position on the Lord's Supper in an even further direction, where the understanding of Christ's presence becomes even more spiritual, less physical, in a way that makes not just some of the more hardcore Lutherans uncomfortable, but the Calvinists are developing views that the Lutherans will consider to be outright heretical. So these are issues that are dividing the Protestants themselves. The territory where Kepler was raised and where he attended school at the University of Tübingen, is staunchly Lutheran, very committed to the idea of Christ's bodily presence in the elements of the Lord's Supper. And Württemberg is bumping right up against another territory, the Palatinate, which is, for the most part, staunchly Calvinist in its interpretation. So there's this strong debate going on between Württemberg and the Palatinate. The University of Heidelberg is located in the Palatinate and becomes eventually a center of some of these Calvinist ideas. So even growing up, Kepler is aware of these knockdown, drag-out debates among the Lutherans themselves, but also between Lutherans and Calvinists, and has trouble understanding the Lutheran position. He is a Lutheran, but on this particular question of the real presence of Christ in the sacrament, he sides with the Calvinists on this issue. And for the Lutherans, particularly in Württemberg, this is a dangerous, even heretical position to take. There is a precedent at the University of Tübingen where a mathematics and astronomy professor had actually been dismissed from the university for holding a position similar to that of Kepler, that is, siding with the Calvinists on this question. Ironically, it's because of the dismissal of this other professor that provides the occasion for Michiel Meslin to come to Tübingen and to have such an important influence on Kepler with regard to Copernican cosmology. But the theological question becomes a very, very different matter. Kepler's theology professors do not convince him of the Lutheran position. By this time, the matter is so important that there's another document that the Lutherans produced in 1577, the Formula of Concord. Formula of Discord probably would be a better title for the document with regard to its impact in some areas. But it is a document that nails down, primarily against the Calvinists, this Lutheran position on real presence. And by this time, it's a requirement for every public official, which includes not just theology professors, but pastors within the territory of Württemberg, to officially sign this document, which Kepler is prepared to do as long as he can make an exception to this one particular article. That, of course, is denied him. So because of this position, with regard to this, what today we might consider a fine point of theological controversy, Kepler is directed to the position in Graz when it becomes open. The faculty of the University of Tübingen think that this is a solution to a number of problems and a way to make better use of Kepler's own talents and abilities.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. And there's a bit of commentary that one could read into about the time and of the Reformation itself. I mean, the Reformation starts out with Luther actually questioning some of the orthodoxy of the Catholic Church. And so a precedent is set that, hey, you got to question some of this orthodoxy and start thinking about where these things develop. But then over the course of the next 50 or 60 or 70 years, and all of a sudden Kepler is inserted into this environment, Lutheranism has a bit of its own orthodoxy once again, and Kepler is looking at this. And it's interesting, he happens to be geographically placed, as you mentioned, between these two intellectual streams, the Lutheranism and Calvinism, and scientifically minded, as we would say today, and doing a lot of this questioning. This must be very interesting and really form the basis for his theological worldviews. I mean, he becomes somewhat of a theological rebel, doesn't he?
Well, he does. He becomes something of a theological rebel in a very complicated and complex context. Remember, he's a Lutheran who has Calvinist positions on certain theological questions, like this issue of real presence, and yet spends the majority of his life working in territories that are predominantly Roman Catholic, including under a Roman Catholic emperor. So the whole complexity of the religious world at the time is embodied in his own life and career. He is constantly bumping up against this. Now, one thing that I think is really important to remember here is we tend to think about this this era as one in which a lot of developments are happening in religion and theology. A lot of developments are happening in what we eventually call science. And so we look back and see this budding conflict between theology and science. But remember, what gets Kepler in trouble on a religious basis has nothing to do with his scientific work. It's his theological position. Remember that Michiel Mesolin is a committed Copernican teaching at the staunchly Lutheran University of Tübingen. He's not getting in trouble for his Copernicanism, neither Mesolin nor Kepler. That's not to say that that theologically Copernicanism is being embraced at the time. It's just that it's a distortion to think that that Copernicanism is the theological dividing point that's at work at the time. It's not that at all. It's these confessional questions that have to do with these theological issues.
And that's a really important point, because not only does this go on with Kepler, who is probably the lesser known of the intellectual rebels at the time, but later on, a few decades later, somebody named Galileo gets in trouble for similar things. We tend to associate, you know, nowadays the very simple trope of why Galileo got in trouble was because he thought the sun was at the center of the universe, but that had nothing to do with it. It was some of these theological debates.
Well, it doesn't have everything to do with it. That's for sure. That's of course a story of its own that has its own history behind it. But you are quite right that that the sort of inner theological world is. Needs to be taken into account in trying to make sense out of the Galileo story. Galileo is also a committed Christian. He does not at all see Copernicanism at odds with the truth of Christianity. Galileo also subscribes to this two-book tradition of the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture, and tries to harmonize them. One of the things that we have to remember that one of the things that is making the Roman Catholic Church very nervous at this point is also the Protestant Reformation. Part of what gets Galileo in trouble is when he, as a layperson, begins to try to make theological arguments that themselves are contradictory to not only the teaching of the Church, but to the authority of the Church at that point. So it's not purely an issue of Copernicanism versus theology or religion. There are all these sort of inner workings that are going on, all of these backstories that are very integral to the world of that time. We tend, I think, to sort of abstract out of that context the issues that are of interest to us and then present that as if it were the entire story, when the reality is far, far more complicated than that.
And I want to explore that a little bit now, these theological undertones. Actually, they probably were not undertones at the time. They were probably right there front and center. And in the two papers that you sent me, and they're extremely interesting papers, you use phrases that are attributed to Kepler himself that really reflect some of his rebellious thinking, and also some of his ecumenical thinking. It's interesting to note in your papers that not only was he arguing against some orthodoxies, but he also was trying to find a bridge that was common to all Christian denominations at the time. But the two phrases that you use, and I'll give you a chance to explain these. The first one is Kepler saying, "I am neither a Lutheran nor a Calvinist." And then the second one, also very interesting, "One should be pious, but not at all too pious." Mm-hmm. What's going on in his thinking with these things?
Well, the where Kepler says I'm neither a Lutheran nor a Calvinist, he actually adds into that mix a Jesuit. So he gets sort of the Catholic side into this as well. Kepler was very disturbed by the religious discord of the time. Now, I think we need to turn this around a little bit and try to look at the reality of things from the side of the Orthodox. I mean, it's easy to vilify them at this point, but historically and in their context, they see a great deal at stake in these in these issues. The Lutherans I know best in this story, and they've come to see they've come to see history itself unfolding as this centuries-long battle between God and the devil, where the devil is using falsehood to undermine the truth of the gospel. And so these theological formulations, as precise as they are seen at defending the truth because a great deal is at stake there. Kepler takes another point of view, though. He's not interested in this kind of theological precision. He's more interested in finding as common a basis for uniting theological differences as possible. So for Kepler, the authority of Scripture is primary. The authority of the early church then becomes secondary after the authority of Scripture. And then finally, the more recent formulations in the form of confessional statements like the Augsburg Confession or the Formula of Concord or a variety of other documents that get written as interpretations of these higher authorities. Now, on the surface, the Orthodox would not disagree with that hierarchy of authority. It's just that they would claim that their confessional documents are accurate representations about what the meaning of Scripture, what the meaning of the early church is all about. Whereas for Kepler, these documents represent more innovations that shouldn't be weighted as heavily as they're being used in practice. So what Kepler advocates is going back to the early centuries of the church, using the early church authorities as a basis for a broader authority for trying to find some commonality across the confessional divide, not just between Lutherans and Calvinists, but with the Catholics as well, since he also moved in those circles and had many contacts with Catholics. The phrase about being pious but not too pious comes at the beginning of a virtually unknown work of Kepler, his Glauben Bekenntnis, his Confession of Faith.
Whoa! Repeat that again. You're trained in German, as I'm correct, and I saw that in your paper, and I said I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. It's just too scary. So what was that work again?
It's not as intimidating as it looks. A lot of letters, but it's really very simple. Glauben's Bekenntnis, from the German Glauben, faith, belief, Bekenntnis, confession. It's Kepler's personal confession of faith. He writes this at the time in which it's becoming increasingly clear to him that he's not going to find the reconciliation with the Wurttemberg Church that he's been looking for. When he moves from Prague to the city of Linz to take a teaching position there, he associates with the local Lutheran congregation there, but the pastor of that church, who is also trained at Tübingen, refuses to give Kepler communion because of Kepler's Calvinist position on the issue of real presence. Kepler makes an appeal back at the University of Tübingen to intervene, but they refused to do so. Kepler had also previously, when he was forced out of Prague to go to Linz, initially what he wanted to do was to achieve his lifelong ambition, once he began his teaching career, of coming back to Tübingen to teach at the university there. That door was also closed to him because of this religious question. Kepler's refusal to sign the Formula of Concord because of his objection to this Article 8 dealing with the issue of Christ's bodily presence in the sacrament closed the door to him, not only for a teaching position at the University of Tübingen, but closed the path to the altar to him at his congregation in Linz. And the faculty, the theological faculty at the University of Tübingen, ends up, once again, siding against Kepler defending the position of the Lutheran pastor in Linz. So at this point, Kepler writes his own confession of faith, and this phrase that he quotes at the beginning is actually an old German saying, one should be pious, but not too pious, and then Kepler immediately follows that up by saying, I've never been able to do this. That the religious issues, the religious questions, matters of faith are too important for him to compromise.
And that's such a fascinating statement, because you talk about this Article 8 in the formula of Concord about the real presence of Christ. I mean, for me, I'm not a great theologian, and a lot of these debates seem to be angels dancing on pins in some respect. But this Article 8 at the time really seems to be a litmus test for employment at these universities. And the fact that he really has the courage to still stand up and say, no, you know what, I'm not going to do this. That's an intellectually courageous move at the time.
Yep. To Kepler's teacher, he was being merely stubborn and hard-headed, and they saw that if they were to allow him to teach at the University of Tübingen, they were concerned about the potential corrosive influence that not only he might have personally, as a result of his position, but what it would signal in a broader sense by allowing someone with a Calvinist position into their fold. But for Kepler, this is a matter of not just principle and conviction, but it's a matter of faith. It's a theological commitment, and he does not feel like it's up to him to be able to budge on that question.
Fill us in a little bit more on that. You touched upon this whole formula of Concord and the Article 8 here at various points in time, but give us a fuller understanding of what is really at stake here, and you know, to what extent this mattered between, say, Lutherans and Calvinists. For somebody who, you know, like me, is not too theologically deep.
Okay. Well, again, the issue has to do primarily, I mean, this does sound like counting the number of angels dancing on pins to us, but there is something that I think very critical at stake here that actually does have something to do with the way that people understood and appreciated the natural order. It has to do with this. For Luther and for the Lutherans, it's very important to understand that when we receive the elements of communion, that Christ is not just there spiritually, but also physically. And what's at stake there is the issue of the incarnation itself. That is the presence of God in Christ coming into the world, not only as a divine being, but also as a human one. So what this means then for Luther and the Lutherans, it makes a very close bond, you see, between God the Creator and the creation. God embraces the creation, identifies with it, and becomes a part of it. Which means in theological terms then that when we receive the body and blood of Christ through the elements of the Lord's Supper, that we are encountering God not just spiritually but physically, down to the very core of our being. So this idea then that God embraces the world, God embraces humans as spiritual creatures, as physical creatures, and that God embraces the physical order through the elements of bread and wine, really becomes a significant statement about God as creator and the relationship between creator and creation. What the Lutherans are afraid of in the Calvinist position is that, at least in part, is that it makes too great a distinction between the spiritual order and the natural order, and they see the very reality of salvation itself undermined because the Calvinist position, as the Lutherans interpret it, means that in the elements of the Lord's Supper, that we are not that God is not encountering us physically. And what's at stake here is that it's all of us that are saved, not just ourselves as spiritual beings, but as physical creatures as well. So this idea about how God relates to the created order as a whole, there is something cosmological at stake here.
He also not only took issue with some of this, the Lutheran documents along this line, you know, through the Formula of Concord, but he also had a few beefs with Calvinists as well, too, because I guess one would say, well, if you don't like the Formula of Concord, why don't you just become a Calvinist? That'd be all
exactly,
good.
Yeah.
But he had a few beefs with the Calvinists, too, about issue over free will. And what's going on here?
Well, of course, Calvinists are known for their view of predestination as it emerges out of this time. The Lutherans had an idea of predestination as well, but it's defined in a little bit different terms than that of the Calvinists. Actually, Kepler had some questions about the Lutheran understanding of free will versus predestination as well. He can't side with the Calvinists completely because of their understanding of predestination, which he sees as determinism and a violation of free will, so he can't go to that side. He's also getting pressure from his Catholic and Jesuit associates when he's working in a Catholic context to convert to Catholicism. And he refuses to go in that direction, too. And part of the tragic element of all of this is, of course, the 30 Years' War breaks out in 1618, which is the great war of religious conflict going on from 1618 to 1648 that just devastates all of Europe around religious questions. Political politics gets involved, too. It's, a very complicated situation. So his entire life is wrapped up in the tragedy of these issues that ends up in open warfare in 1618, which is something that he had feared and hoped would never come to pass.
And it's interesting that he comes to this conclusion of greater ecumenism. I mean, he's trying to find, as I mentioned before, common bridges across all the denominations, and one really understands his political, historical context and how that really does affect his theology. Go ahead.
There's an interesting and also somewhat unknown point to this. In 1604, when there's a new star that appears in the sky today, what we would call a nova. In fact, the term nova comes from this time period. So today we would recognize it as an exploding star. Of course, at the time it gets a lot of attention, and Kepler writes about this phenomenon that appears in 1604. And of course, for people of the time, there's all sorts of astrological significance attached to this, and many people are seeing this as a sign of the end of the world. Kepler also provides his own interpretation to it, where he takes kind of a different path. For Kepler, the star doesn't portend the end of the world, but rather for him a sign of a coming reform for the Church, that is continuing reform, and a time of peace that is yet to come before the end of the world. Now, part of this he buys into. To the theological thinking of the time that before Christ comes, that the Jews will convert and all of this kind of thing. But Kepler has this streak of optimism in spite of the tragic events that are going on that even make an impact on the way that he interprets astrologically things that are going on around him. So. I think it would be easy in this time of conflict and turmoil to see these kinds of events as signs like, well, the end of history is near, God's going to come in and just wipe all of this out. That even in the midst of this personal and social and cultural and religious turmoil, Kepler sees this as portending a sign of hope. hope and peace and further reform in the church. And so I think part of this is also what's driving him for this broader ecumenical vision for the church as being kind of the fulfillment of this coming time of continuing reform.
And definitely, again, going counter to a lot of the thinking of the days. And one of the things that I liked in your paper that you mentioned is he was in a debate with one of his former mentors, Matthias Hoffenreffer, if I pronounced that correctly. And Hoffenreffer, you know, is a former teacher of Kepler, writes to him, and I guess through a series of letters, and I have to mention this because I just think it's so funny. Hoffenreffer writes, "Either I am stupid and out of my mind, or you are," when it comes to these debates. And I just had to snicker because I get into a lot of these academic debates where we end up, you know, calling each other names, and I am not immune to that. And so it's good to see that that happened, you know, some, you know, 400, 500 years ago too.
Actually, Kepler and Hoffenreffer were very close. So they liked and admired each other very much. They maintained this. Hoffenreffer was about 10 years older than Kepler. He came to Tübingen late in Kepler's student career, but they maintained this correspondence and this close relationship. Kepler actually admired Hoffenreffer's mathematical skills that he applied in a couple of different ways. But they could not come to terms over this issue of real presence. And to read this correspondence is just painful because you can see the mutual admiration they have for each other, and yet how each just digs in his heels because of what they see at stake in the issue that's dividing them, and it's really a very painful thing. Their correspondence ends when Hoffenreffer dies in 1619, so kind of right at the climax of a lot of these debates and issues, and it's really to me a very painful part of the story to read this.
Yeah, interesting observation that oftentimes the people that we have the closest association with, we oftentimes have some of the most vigorous disagreements with.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if I've ever been overly critical of somebody out there, and you think that I don't like you, it's just because I'm overly critical because I love you very much.
There
so
you go.
Yeah, that's my thing there. What impact does Kepler have on the theological scholarship of his day? I mean, we can talk about his scientific stuff. That a lot of other people do that. But what is fascinating about your work is that you look at his theological thinking. As we mentioned, he's somewhat of a rebel. He's not a Lutheran. He's not a Calvinist. He's not a Jesuit. He's in between all these cracks. He's trying to build ecumenical bridges. He's critical of orthodoxy. Does this matter at all, or is he just somebody who's spitting in the wind?
As far as his impact on the theological questions, as much as I hate to say it, I think his impact is probably not much. I think that what interests me about Kepler, though, is the way that he symbolizes and in his own experience and work pulls together all of these that appear to us to be very diverse strands of society and culture, and we see them embodied in the life of this one individual. Now he does represent and advocate this approach to the interpretation of Scripture that we also find in Galileo, where the way that he deals with what seems to be a growing divide between our knowledge of the cosmos and what the Bible seems to represent, is to argue that we have to remember that the Bible is, even in Kepler's time, is written ages and ages and ages ago. And so Kepler argues, well, of course the texts are written in a way that they speak meaningfully to the people of that time. That is, that the Holy Spirit, by inspiring the writers of Scripture to write what they write, writes in such a way that the text is accommodated, that's the key term here, accommodated to the thinking of people at the time. So we shouldn't expect to read in the Bible ways of looking at the world that correspond to our own understanding. That's not what the Bible is intended to do. We see a very similar line of argument in Galileo in his own defense. Now, again, I don't think that for Kepler, his particular articulation of this argument has that great of an impact. What I do think we see in Kepler, though, is someone who is representing a position that comes to gain traction later on after his time.
Let me go ahead and conclude in our final minutes here with a question that I always ask of our guests who deal with historical topics, and that is a reflection. To what extent does your studying of Kepler, and you've been at this for quite a while, you know the details in and out, it's an interesting historical episode, and it reflects a lot of those times, but is there anything that you've pulled out from your historical studies of Kepler that help you to understand our contemporary world a little bit better?
Well, yes, I think so. One is this impression that is still very pervasive in our culture, that there is this long-standing conflict between science and religion. The historical record just doesn't support that. That impression comes largely from 19th century formulations of the historical record. When we look back at what's going on, what we see is something far more complicated than that. Part of what I enjoy in working with students around this topic is to introduce them to that complexity. In fact, in a lot of the work now around the history of religion and science, complexity, that term is becoming more so than conflict as the way of describing what's going on, and the recognition that when we look in the past at the record for how these things develop, that we really risk distorting the record if we simply abstract out of it the ideas that appeal to us and see what's going on as a battle of ideas without also taking into account the social and cultural context and realities out of which those ideas arise. That's part of what I really enjoy and find fascinating is to see how these ideas are incarnated, not just in their own particular historical context, but in the very real biographies of individuals who carry these ideas and bring them forward.
Well, that is one of the things that we always try to do here on Research on Religion, especially with our historical topics, and it's wonderful having Russell Cluckley as our guest. Russell, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.